So what I want to do is talk about this concept of happiness. Sometimes philosophers these days talk of flourishing as the word they use. And I want to go back to Aristotle at the beginning. So Aristotle, in his Nicomachean Ethics, a book he wrote at least ostensibly for his son, not to make him ethical, but to explain what ethics is about, starts fairly early with this little argument. We make bridles, he says. Why do we make bridles? Well, we make bridles to help us ride horses. I'm going to embroider the argument a little bit, but the ideas are his. Why ride horses? So we make bridles to ride horses, but if riding horses is pointless, making bridles then is going to be pointless. But fortunately, we have a use for riding horses. For Aristotle, that's winning battles. You wouldn't do it for fun or something like that. And he's talking to the noble classes who wouldn't be doing it just for farm labor or something. So we ride horses to win battles. Now we might ask, what's the point of winning battles? And here I'm guessing what Aristotle might be thinking. We win battles to preserve our freedom. But what's the point of the freedom? Well, Aristotle's point in this little line of thought is that we cannot go on forever here. Right? We cannot go on forever for a couple of reasons. Right? One is just we're finite. We don't have an infinite number of aims. They just wouldn't fit in our minds. Right? So obviously our list of goals cannot go on forever. But also, if it went on forever, there would be kind of pointlessness to it all. It would be, imagine that you do something for the sake of achieving some maybe a goal tomorrow, and tomorrow you do it for the sake of a goal for the day after, and so on forever. Well, then it's pointless. So it's not just that our minds are too small to have an infinite number of goals. If we just did one thing for the sake of another for the sake of that, it would be we would in the end be doing things pointlessly. The whole sequence of actions would be pointless. So we can't go on forever. And so Aristotle concludes there's got to be some things that we pursue for their own sake. Some things that are worth having for their own sake, and not because they do something else for us. So in this list, maybe freedom is like that, right? So maybe we want freedom for its own sake, and the question of what's our freedom for is not a good one to ask, because freedom is just worth having for its own sake. Clearly, bridles are not that. We don't want to stop at bridles. Bridles, it would be very weird to just make bridles for its own sake. Riding horses. Depends, right? People do ride horses just for fun. So maybe in a different society than Aristotle's, there maybe somebody could stop. So this problem that I'll be thinking about is this problem of what are the things that are worth having for their own sake? And I'm going to call those things with the nice English word happiness. Yes. Or the more philosophical term flourishing. So those things that are worth having for their own sake, I'm just going to call that happiness. So this is, ordinarily, what people in English mean by happiness is some kind of a pleasant feeling. That might turn out to be what happiness is, but it's not true by definition. What I mean by happiness is just whatever it is that turns out to be the thing worth having for their own sake. And maybe that turns out to be a good feeling of some sort, then that's happiness. But maybe it'll turn out to be something else. One of the ancient Greeks thought that pain was one of those things. Antisthenes. This is clearly wrong, but it's not wrong by definition. It's a substantive question. What is it that's worth having? Okay. So we're going to ask what these things are. All right. So let's meet. Let's see if we can do this by thinking of some examples. So let's meet some candidates for things worth having for their own sake. So pleasure comes to mind, right? It sure seems like it's really nice to feel pleasure. Pleasure, it comes in all sorts of varieties. There's physical pleasure. There is psychological pleasure. There's all sorts of deep intellectual pleasures one can have in science, in mathematics, in literature, and so on. Lots of different kinds of pleasure one can have. And they seem worth having. Maybe a broad variety of experiences. So pleasure is one experience, one kind of experience, but maybe we want a variety of experiences that goes beyond just the pleasant ones. Maybe not a complete mix, like we probably don't want to add in our mix of experiences being tortured by the Gestapo for a week. That's too much variety. But we may want to include some pain. It helps, with enjoying life to struggle and overcome pain and so on. So a variety of experience, the right kind of variety. Fulfillment of desires and achievements. There's stuff we want to have. We want to have happen to us. We make plans for our lives. We have hopes for our lives. We hope, okay, I will graduate. I will graduate with such and such a GPA. I will, I will one day run a 4-minute mile. All sorts of goals we set for ourselves, and some of them may be much higher than these ones. Maybe one sets oneself the goal of contributing to the end of cancer. Or some of them might be lower than this. I will have the largest match collection of any human being. We can have all sorts of desires, and it seems like there's something good about getting them fulfilled. Maybe not in every single case. We might have some worries about perverse desires, but in many cases, there seems to be something good about achieving our goals. We set goals, and then we achieve them. This is a lot of what sports is about, is you set goals, or the kind of artificial goals, and then you achieve those goals, or surpass them, or something like that, or approach them. Health, obviously something that's worth having, Money seems worth having. Lots of people, at least, if you think what people actually pursue is seems to be evidence of what they find valuable, and money is something lots of people, including myself, pursue. Reputation, right? So we want people to think well of us. We want that to happen in large numbers. Ideally, we want lots of people to think well of us. Sometimes we just want people to think of us. We don't care too much about whether it's well or not. And then we have our girlfriends shoot us through a phone book while making a YouTube video. That maybe isn't the right kind of reputation to gain, but there is this drive all of us human beings have towards wanting to be famous in some way. Or if we can't have fame, then at least we can have infamy. Of course, there's moral goodness or virtue. That seems to be also one of those things that's worth having. At the very least, we could say this. Almost every human being, if they could have moral goodness or virtue without sacrificing any of the items above it on the list, would be happy to have it. maybe there's a few people who, you know, want to be evil for its own sake, but most people would, you know, if they are not pursuing goodness, it's mostly because they want something else as well. But it's not because they don't think goodness is worth having. Friendship and love, right? This is, you know, this is very trite, but I think very deep in us, that we don't want to be alone. We want to be with others. We want to have friendships. We want to have love of a broad variety of sorts. We want to have friendships and love, and sibling love, and parent-child love, and romantic love, all kinds of love. We want many of them. And we want truth. Right? So perhaps a part of the reason we study different subjects is because we want the truth about them. It's good to know. There's an enjoyment we have of knowing things. Maybe sometimes it can be a little perverse, as we have a special enjoyment of knowing things that other people don't know, or finding things out first. But it's still, we want to know we want to know things. And what we want to know, of course, is the truth, because that's the only thing we can know. Okay. So let's think about these candidates. We are looking, right? So we're looking for things that are worth having for their own sake. And we also want things, let's add a little more to this search. We want things that will satisfy us. So we want happiness. And for happiness, by definition, has got to satisfy. It's got to give us what we need to flourish. So we want things that are worth having for their own sake, and that will in some deep way give us complete satisfaction if we have them. So before we do that, let's think about two stories. So here's a simpler story, and then a somewhat refined version. The fake life. You have gazillionaire parents who pay millions of actors around you. Like, this will require some science fiction to work. All the people you ever meet with on this story are among the millions of actors hired by your extremely rich parents. Many of these actors pretend to be great friends of yours. They're really good actors. They are better. They feel like better friends than the friends that most people actually have. They may play basketball with you and convince you that you're incredible by, you know, playing less well than you, while others pretend that these are the stars of the basketball life, and hiding from you any video of actual professional basketball players. They time you running a 3-minute mile, beating the world record with a stopwatch that runs slow. They praise your poetry and tell you that you've won the Nobel Prize in Literature for it. Feels great, right? They will even arrange for you to be an incredibly successful president of at least a small European country, where you will have achieved such things as the complete elimination of poverty and inequality through your dedication and single-handed efforts. Well, not single-handed efforts in between, you know, playing world-class basketball and running 3-minute miles and writing amazing poetry. Of course, all of this is fake. But it feels completely real to you. And so the question to ask, is that what we want from life? Do we want something like this? Well, when we think about stories like that, I think we think, yeah, but I could tell. In some level, I'm going to tell it's a fake. You know, you watch good movies with good actors, and it's still a little bit fake. Even the best actors, they're not really like ordinary people around us. There is something not quite right. It may be very close, but not quite right. There's something we would miss out on. The true friend would be a little bit different. Obviously, the feel of the wind rushing by you as you run your 3-minute mile that maybe takes 10 minutes is very different from the hypothetical actual 3-minute mile. So, this isn't quite, I think it might actually be good enough for making us feel like we've made it, but we might also have this feeling this has been faked, or there's something a little bit off. So to overcome that kind of worry, the philosopher Robert Nozick imagined a more thorough story. So imagine, if you've seen the Matrix movies, you can visualize it that way, or you can visualize it this way. Imagine a machine that can give you any set of life experiences you could ever want. And it does it directly to the brain. So it can fake the feel of what it is like to have the wind rushing by you as you run your 3-minute mile and all that. And it will feel just like it would feel. And you will feel just as exhausted as you would if you had, after decades of training, achieved this milestone in human athleticism. The machine can do it. It could simulate for you a life of a Napoleon, a Mother Teresa, an Einstein, a sports star, a successful politician, or combinations of these. The machine has files prepared by experts. Experts who know what pleases human beings, who know what kind of mixes of experiences seem to be really good for us, what kind of things people seek, what kind of lives we consider valuable. And they prepare these files with extreme skill. There's nothing, this is not a whitewashed life where you have just pleasure. This is a life where, in the machine, where you feel like you've overcome great adversity, where you have, in fact, suffered significant pain, a loss, and so on, in the machine. But it is all carefully calibrated so that there isn't too much suffering. Your life isn't going to end in a concentration camp in this scenario. But, you know, maybe you will actually spend several months in a concentration camp, and it will lead to great spiritual insights that will transform the rest of your life. Well, not a real concentration camp, of course, but a computer file of one. So this is all really well optimized. When you go into the machine, your memories are wiped, because knowing that it's fake would, of course, affect our enjoyment. It just wouldn't be the same thing. We definitely need that. We need, for this to really work well, we need a complete suspension of this belief, and so that requires a memory wipe. That, I admit, is very scary, at least for me. To make it a little bit less scary, Nozick allows for this little mitigation of it. You do have to go in for life to this machine, but you can choose to wake up yearly to switch files. Because you might have just made a stupid mistake in choosing which kind of life you want. Maybe you thought, I really want the Mother Teresa life. And then you've had like a year of the Dark Night of the Soul in the simulation. And you say, no, 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 this is not me. I want Napoleon. Right? So, yeah, you might make a mistake. But, you know, so there is risk involved in this. But on the mitigated version, the risk is less than the risks we ordinarily take in our lives. When we set our lives and look plan for the future, we take risks. And what is at risk is much more than a year of our lives. So this actually, in this scenario, the risk is actually less than in our life. So the Nozick question is that what we want from life? How many of you want this? How many of you want this kind of fulfillment? So sometimes, one thing that's actually we're thinking about is it may depend on what the alternative is, right? So if the alternative is an incredibly miserable life, then you might say, okay, yeah, this is like anesthesia from that. It's you know, you don't normally want anesthesia unless you're actually in pain, but when you're in pain, you do really want it, maybe. But the Nozick question is, do you want this as opposed to the ordinary things that in an ordinary human life we get? And Nozick thought, probably not. But there are people who want this, and they won't be convinced by Nozick's arguments. So suppose we think, as Nozick did, that this is not what we are after in life. Then when we go back to our list of candidates for happiness, we can delete some. Pleasure and variety of experience cannot constitute most of happiness, because we can have those in the experience machine and maybe even in the fake life. And as for pleasure by itself, if it's just pleasure, raw pleasure, incredibly intense pleasure can be just electrically generated. And yet that's probably not what we should be going for. What about this? Fulfillment of desires and achievement. Is the fulfillment of our desires what our happiness consists in? So here's a thought experiment. We've got Alice. She's brainwashed to have one desire in life, to eat mud. She eats her fill of mud and dies, having achieved what she wanted, namely to eat her fill of mud. She had a plan for her life. She fulfilled that plan. She got exactly everything she wanted in life. At some cost, perhaps. You know, the mud might have been a bit disgusting to eat. It might not have been pleasant to eat, but that was what she wanted to achieve. But surely she's not fulfilled in life. Achievement, just having your desires fulfilled, is not enough for happiness. Not if your desires are not themselves worth having. What about health? Health is worth having for its own sake. It's an important prerequisite for many things worth having, but it is quite possible to have health, both physical and mental, and be miserable, fairly miserable, lonely, bored, and so on. Maybe there's a level of misery at which you might count as depressed, and maybe that counts as unhealthy, though it's not actually clear that if the reason you're miserable is because things are going badly for you, that would count as depression. That probably wouldn't count as depression. It would just count as a sober appreciation of the realities of your life, and you could be physically and mentally healthy, I think, and still miserable. Health, while it's valuable for its own sake, I think it's largely we want it because it gives us other things, right? It just makes no sense to make the kinds of sacrifices that people make for their health if health was all there was. We make these sacrifices for health because there's other things we want to do with that health. Maybe we want to live longer so we can spend more time among people we care about. Maybe we want to have the health so that we can run faster. lots of possibilities, but we don't, but a lot of the effort that we expend on our health is because the health is good for something else. So health, I think, is valuable for its own sake, but it's not going to come close to giving us happiness. Money is a clear case. Money is really something that is just obviously something that's not worth having for its own sake. It's worth having for what you can buy with it. That's what money is for. You can buy with it material goods, you can buy power, all sorts of things can be bought with it, but it is for buying, not for its own sake. Reputation. So this is an Aristotle point with slight changes in the wording of the argument. You don't want to get a medal from the KKK. You don't want to be honored by people you despise. That would be terrible. That would be the wrong. What we all want is to be thought well of by people that we ourselves think well of. Right? We don't want to be, if people we think really terribly of think well of us, that worries us. Right? That's something that suggests we've gone wrong. Right? So you want, you know, we can all name people whose respect for us would really worry us. And Aristotle says, here's what's going on. We want to have a good reputation with people we respect. And he says the reason for this is that when we have a good reputation with worthy people, that's a sign of our worthiness of a good reputation. It's when the people that we respect us, that's a sign that things are, that we are doing well, that we are acting well. We want, so what Aristotle thinks is that when we think about in more detail as to what kind of reputation we want, we actually want to be worthy of respect rather than just to have the respect. Now again, not everybody is like that. There are the people who do the crazy YouTube things and sometimes die in doing so. But I think we have a general feeling this is a perversion of the desire for reputation. Humans are hard to satisfy. And this is like one of the deep truths of human life, one of those deep philosophical truths, right? We are really hard to satisfy. Whatever we get, we seem to be unsatisfied. I haven't finished going through the candidates, though. There's four more at the end. Something like art and beauty, moral goodness, friendship and love, truth. I should have had that on the list of candidates. I think I omitted it from that one. These things seem to be worth having for their own sake. And they seem to contribute not just marginally to our happiness, but quite substantially to our happiness. Okay. So there seem to be some things that do contribute quite substantially to our happiness. So that's hopeful. There are things we can have that contribute substantially to our happiness. But there is a problem. Death. Again, this is super trite. You could, you know, if you go home, you could tell me, what does this philosopher tell you? He told us humans are hard to satisfy and death is bad. Well, death, right? Death gets in the way of happiness, right? Why? Well, let's think about those things towards the end of the list. Moral goodness. Almost nobody managed to achieve the kind of moral goodness that we should be pursuing in this life. Maybe some do, but almost nobody does. death cuts short the process. Moreover, this is an insight Aristotle had, is that we don't just want to have goodness, we want to practice goodness. He gives this example, he has this little saying, the Olympic medals are not given to the fastest or the strongest. They're not. I could be the fastest man in the world, but unless I actually run, I'm not going to get any medals. What is good is not just being able to run fast, but actually running fast. That is what, and similarly for moral goodness, Aristotle says, imagine that you have perfect virtue. You do, all your inclinations are correct. You have all the right motivations, and you spend all your life in a coma. With your moral perfection locked up inside your unconscious mind. That is not a happy life. The happy life is not just the having of the goodness, but the practicing of the goodness. And death cuts short that practice. We want to practice, not just have goodness. Death seems to cut short friendships and love before we've gotten to know our friends well enough. This is one of those things, right? We keep on getting to know our friends, and we are never done. And death cuts short that. It gives regrets, sometimes because it is our own fault that we didn't get to know them as well as we could have, and sometimes it is not our fault, it is just the nature of things that we didn't share enough, couldn't share enough time with them. Death cuts this short. So moral goodness is incomplete because of death. Friendship and love are incomplete. We certainly, the search for truth is cut short by death. And we may finally start getting, figuring things out in whatever things we're thinking about. And then our mental powers start deteriorating and eventually, death comes. We don't have enough time to gain much knowledge of truth. We think about how few areas one can study in depth. There's a lot of students who are double majors, very few who are triple majors, almost no quadruple majors. I have not met a quintuple major. I don't know that I actually met a quadruple major. Why? Life is short. You can't, you just don't have time to learn enough truth. So death is a problem for happiness. What about the opposite of death? What if instead of, I mean, here I'm assuming death was the end, which of course is a controversial question, and maybe it's not. What if we look at the opposite side? What if instead we think of eternity? Would eternity give us happiness? We can lose ourselves in pleasures, but eventually, won't they all start looking the same? Won't we just start repeating pleasures that we've had already, maybe 10,000 years ago? How many novels are there that are about 2,000 pages long? If a novel's more than 2,000 pages long, there's something wrong, right? You shouldn't have to write more than 2,000 pages. Okay, I've got a short attention span, but I think this is actually a correct judgment. But there's a finite number of novels of 2,000 pages. Right, it's about, you know, something like 10 million or so, approximately, give or take some stuff in the exponent. That sounds like a lot. That's an enormous amount of novels. But if you're living literally for this amount of time, you'll run out of those novels as a writer,
or as a reader. You will just be rereading or plagiarizing, depending on whether you're reading or writing, right?
I mean, think of it literally. At some point, if everybody is writing a new 2,000-page novel, or all the writers at least, in our happy eternity are writing new 2,000-page novels, eventually all of them will have been written. And now any new novel will be basically plagiarism. Maybe not literally plagiarism, because maybe you don't know that somebody else has written it, but that's actually kind of frustrating. It's not satisfying to create this work of art and know that somebody else has already done exactly the same thing. As a rereading. Likewise, you know, there's a finite number of films that are 2 hours long. And a film shouldn't be more than 2 hours long, I say. Maybe three, if it's one of the parts of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But generally, right, there's a limit to what you can do. And past a certain amount of time, it's going to stop. Whatever that amount of time is, even if we say, okay, we're going to be watching really long films, or we're making really long films, still, whatever length you set, eventually, you just get reruns. Maybe you can keep on making your films longer. Yeah. But notice that eventually they will all start the same way. Eventually, like the first year of each film, maybe we overcome this endless repetition in eternity by making films that are longer and longer. Eventually, we're making these films that last for decades. And notice, though, that what will happen is that like the first years of the film will be a rerun of something we've already seen. But now we're wondering, how will it go? It'll go differently, I guess, after that. But actually, the second part will also be something we've seen. We just haven't seen it in combination with this. This is not satisfying. An eternity of reruns. No. What about living for endless time with perfect virtue? But then you wonder, so what is there left to achieve? You have this virtue now, and isn't that kind of boring, just to have it? It takes us a long time to get to know friends. The 70 to 100 years or so that we have is not nearly enough. But while it takes us a long time, it seems it shouldn't take eternity. There's a finite length of time. I bet after 10,000 years, we'll know our friends really well. And what then? There's still infinity years left to be bored with them. So this is the Eeyore part of the talk, right? You die or you don't. You die and your life ends, or you continue living forever. Either case, there is a problem for our happiness. And for truth, too, are there enough interesting truths to fill infinite time? Notice, again, if truths are things that can be expressed by words, there's a finite number of truths that are less than 2,000 pages long. You might think all the deep truths of human thought can be expressed in a page, at most. Then you're done. After a finite amount of time, all those pages will have been written. So permanent death rules out full happiness. So our full happiness has to be in something that can go on forever, if there is such a thing as our full happiness. Nothing finite is like that. We can get bored of anything finite. We are finite. So it looks like our full... But since we are finite... So this is the first of the two depressing arguments, the death one. We are finite. But anything finite ends up running out, boring us. Or there just isn't enough time for things. So our fulfillment, I think, requires something infinite outside us that will go on forever. But not just anything. Because as we saw, lots of good things, genuinely good things, the beautiful,
the true, when repeated to eternity, may bore. So we need something infinite outside us to be happy that goes on forever, but not just anything. Now, I think one of those, you know, sort of trite but deep truths of human life is that friendship is a central part of human fulfillment, a central part of human happiness. The person without friends is a miserable person. And if they think they're happy, they're mistaken about that. But eternal friendship seems like we'll bore as well, because we'll have gotten to know our friends perfectly, unless they involve an infinite being. If there's an infinite being, then maybe we need an infinite amount of time to get to know them. It seems that our complete fulfillment in friendship would require something like eternal growth in an eternal relationship with an infinite being. Anything less is not happiness. In eternity, there could be more and more goodness that we could get by a relationship to an infinite being. As with an infinite being, we can always find more to love about the infinite being, more to respect about this infinite being, and more to know about this infinite being. Likewise, our eternal search for truth need not bore us if part of that search involves an infinite being that maybe has infinitely many radically different kinds of attributes. Here's what I'm thinking. Here's some good things. Love, knowledge, power, goodness, beauty. Imagine this. Imagine you didn't know about beauty, but you knew about these other things. I think this is actually possible. Barely. But I think it is actually possible. You could be beauty blind. You would pursue moral goodness. You would love in the sense of, maybe not in the sense of appreciating someone's beauty, not romantic love you might have trouble with, but you could love your neighbor by doing good to your neighbor, and so on, and appreciating their moral goodness, but not their any kind of beauty in them. You could be blind to beauty and still have these, and still recognize these attributes in a friend. And if you were completely blind to beauty, I couldn't explain to you what beauty is, I think. There's some kind of transformation you need to have to see beauty when you haven't seen it before, and words are not capable of causing that transformation. But could be done. Now here's a thought. We are not done with this list, I think. I think just as on our list of good things, we have these things, and including goodness and beauty, there probably are others. It would be very strange, I think, to think we've got them all. I suspect we are all, this is just some kind of epistemic humility maybe, I suspect we are blind with respect to things that are not on this list, yeah, in the way that some people might be blind to beauty. It could well be that there are infinitely many things on this list, like that could be added to this list. I cannot say what they are, because we are blind to them the way that somebody who's blind to beauty cannot understand the beauty part of this list. If this is true, then an infinite being who had these infinitely many radically different attributes like this, would allow us to have this growth of knowledge of truth that wouldn't be just incremental, but would be revelatory. It's like your eyes are open to beauty if you have never seen beauty before. That's a revelation. It's like, you know, there are these cute videos of people who are colorblind getting glasses that restore some measure of color vision, and how excited and happy they are. Imagine that we took somebody who had no experience of beauty and then gave them, maybe because there's some bit of their brain that's missing, and we've now fixed that bit of the brain. Now they experience beauty. That's not just like learning yet another fact of arithmetic or something, or maybe even not like learning yet another theorem of topology. That's like completely transformative of one's knowledge of the world. And if there's an infinite being who has infinitely many attributes like that, then our search for truth can involve an infinite number of transformations. And that does not bore. And even if there is such a being, an infinite being, then even our friendships with finite beings can take on an aspect of infinity to them, because we can understand our friends in relationship to this infinite being, and as they grow in relation with this infinite being infinitely, so too we can grow in a relationship with them. There will be constantly new things about them. The person who continually has revelatory experiences that reveal new aspects of reality is an interesting person, an eternally interesting person. So our friends can be interesting if they live an infinitely long life with an infinite being, at least might be able to. Can we say anything what this life could be like? Can we speculate? Here's a thought. Only a finite amount of information can be stored by a brain of finite size. And so, if we're going to be beings with brains like ours, who live forever, we're going to be stuck with reruns forever. Because the same brain state eventually will have to repeat. Because there aren't going to be new and new states of the brain, because the brain is finite. And so we're not going to be able to get newer and newer states over eternity of the brain. So we're going to have reruns. Which means that if we are purely beings made of matter, with brains and sort of biological beings, the only way we can have this eternal growth as persons, and I mean mental growth, both intellectual and affective, is if we have physical growth as well. Our brains have to get bigger, literally. And remember, we're talking about eternity. Eternity is really long. Those brains would have to get really big. They would eventually be the size of galaxies. Unless maybe the laws of nature somehow are changed in some ways that allow things to happen at smaller scales. But this seems kind of nutty as an idea, that we have this endless brain growth. And so it seems to me that if true fulfillment is something that's available to us, then we're not purely material beings. We must have souls that don't take space and can grow infinitely. Here's my picture of the soul. No, the soul has no image, right? So we get this, if happiness is to be possible, if full happiness is to be possible for us, it seems like we need to have souls. We need to be capable of living forever, and there needs to be an infinite being for us to have a relationship with. But maybe happiness is not possible for us. Maybe we are the products of evolution. What if evolution has induced in us a hopeless illusion that happiness is possible in order to motivate us to go through life, to go through the hardships of life without getting depressed, in order that our DNA might get passed on to our descendants? And this is like, as you get more intelligence, you get new kinds of evolutionary problems. One problem is the problem of cheating, that counters altruism. Smart beings can cheat. Another problem is the problem of depression. Beings that are smart enough
to go through the arguments that I've gone through earlier are smart enough to get depressed. And depression is not good for passing on one's genes. So maybe evolution has just induced in us this illusion that happiness is possible to keep us from getting depressed. It's evolution's solution to the problem. Just as some people think that religion is evolution's solution to the problem of cheating. It keeps us from cheating on our obligations to our fellow members of the community because we think some being is watching out for us. Could that be what is the case? I think if we don't trust our deepest senses of what we are made for, our drive for happiness, it's going to be hard to trust our moral senses as well. In fact, I think once we say that something so deep in us as the drive for happiness is just an illusion, I think it's other things in us, it's going to be hard to hold up the idea that they're not just illusions. Maybe our mathematical or scientific reasoning is merely evolved to just help us hunt and gather, and when it goes far beyond hunting and gathering, as our science does, we cannot trust it. I think one could say these things, but one shouldn't. That's an undue skepticism. Also, it's a self-undermining skepticism. Once you're this skeptical, you're going to not trust science either, or mathematics, and you're not going to trust evolution itself, believe in evolution either, because that's just comes from science. It seems to me that to think, to know, to live, we need to have a kind of hope in our nature, a hope that we have a nature that isn't at its core perverse, delusory, and so on. If we don't think this, then we really are cutting the branch we sit on in really every kind of sense. We must have a hope in our nature, that in our humanity. Okay, so conclusions. We get an infinite regress or vicious circle, we saw from Aristotle, unless there's something worth having for its own sake. So there is something that's worth having for its own sake. We can call this happiness or flourishing. It involves multiple components, which we can list some of. Probably the list is not exhaustive. But it is not complete unless it is eternal. Unless it involves something infinite, it would bore us even if it were eternal. If we are purely material, we would have endless repetition, or literally swollen heads. Well, maybe not literally. Maybe brains could overflow into our stomachs or something, and then we get a swollen stomachs instead. So it seems to me our drive for happiness signals to us that we are made for knowledge of and friendship with an infinite being, and that we're not just purely material beings, that we are beings of body and soul. I think we should trust these signals with hope. Thank you.